So I know that we would be in Paris if things were more normal.
And I would be about 40 baguettes in by now.
But, yeah, we would be struggling. I'd be wading through pain au chocolat.
And I'd be screaming, I need another baguette.
This is good. I think we probably needed a year off just to cleanse.
Like a detox, isn't it?
But it also would be the beginning of the grass court season.
Oh, okay. It's, as you say, we would be in France, so we're sort of up to our eyeballs in clay around now, and my brain would switch to the grass the minute the finals are finished in Paris. But for you as a player, what did it mean, the start of the grass court season?
It was a combination. I mean, it's completely different being British. I think I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that essentially you are treated like you're in the top 10 for the grass court season, when you most definitely aren't. And you do. I mean, after some of my matches, I had hours worth of press. I mean, you know what it's like. A lot of players don't even get requests for press when they're at Wimbledon. But if you're British, you definitely do. So it's a combination of, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of expectation. It just happened to be my favourite surface as well by quite some way. I was absolutely the best on that surface. And it's a very short season as well, so you have to hit the ground running. A combination of things. But ultimately, the grass was the best time of year, for sure. I mean, there definitely wasn't all positives. But the first tournament I used to play would be Surbiton, which would be on this week. And that was always quite funny, because for me, I thought it was the strongest challenger of the whole year. It was unbelievable, the people who turned up, because they would lose early in French Open and then be desperate to get on the grass. But often back then, I think it's changed a little bit now, but often the practice courts in Arangi at Wimbledon weren't open, particularly if you weren't sort of Roger Federer. So I think if you remember, you could use.
Well, hang on a second. You were a top 10 player during this grass court season.
I know. I should say that. Come on, I'm dealing with everything like a top 10 player. But A, I'm not getting paid like a top 10 player, and I'm not getting the privileges. Yeah, so you would get these huge stars turn up to Surbiton, which was just kind of quite extraordinary. So Sam Querrey used to play a lot. Andy Roddick turned up back in the day. He was top five in the world at the time. He lost first round of French Open because, you know, he liked to do that. And he turned up to Surbiton to play doubles. And he was trying to get into singles. He wanted to take a wild card into the singles, but he just not allowed. You can't play the main draw of such a small event when you're top five in the world. I think the prize money or something was, I'm not sure what it was for the men, maybe $25,000, something like that back then. And Andy Roddick, Grand Slam winning Andy Roddick, is saying, can I play? And the ref's like, no, you can't. But he was allowed to play doubles.
But surely that would be such a boost for the tour. I understand it's taking away the place of someone who needs it more. But maybe you say, right, you can win it, but you don't get the prize money. Surely, for a tournament like that, to have someone like that in their singles draw would be enormous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and he did hold on to a few wild cards, special exempt spots, to see just quite what happened kind of early stages of the French Open, to see if anybody would want to come. But Surbiton's always been a fantastic tournament. Great courts, great. It's a real club as well. It's not kind of a centre. It's not this huge event. It's very small. It's kind of quaint, very British. And they get really good crowds in, actually. So, to get a couple of big names is always good. But I do remember Sam Querrey played a few times. And I remember the year Roddick turned up and played doubles.
ahead of the grass court season, as you've just said, as a British player, you're treated like you're in the top 10 and there's press swarming everywhere and people know your name and all these different things that maybe you don't experience for the rest of the year. Was there any kind of preparation, whether it was the coach or the governing body? Did someone say, right, not physically, because you're doing that all year, but mentally, this is going to be different. It's going to be crazy. And just a little, did you have to prepare yourself mentally for the grass court season?
Well, back when I was playing, there was absolutely nothing. And I think it's because that sort of pressure looms on everyone. It looms on the LTA to get results. It looms on your individual coach to show that they're doing a good job. And you do really kind of get taken out of the bubble. And I suppose all I can say is that the overwhelming feeling, as much as it's such a conflict of emotions, because it is the best time of the year and my best memories, and that's just hands down. But also, when it's over, you and your coach and your team, you wouldn't necessarily, well, we didn't necessarily prepare for it, but when it was done, it was very much kind of a, oh, thank God that's done. We can get back to normal life on the tour now, kind of the normal bits and pieces. It's this very, very strange time, this really weird bubble. And everybody feels like that. I think that unless you reach, of course, like a certain level, or if you've been doing it long enough, but the ones that are young and new and wild cards and that sort of thing, everybody at the end is just kind of, whew. Felt like I was in a washing machine there for a few weeks. And I know that some coaches used to have the tactic that in the second week of the tournament, they would send their players to some rubbish challenger somewhere, some small event, probably on clay, just to be really mean. And I know of a couple of coaches who did it deliberately. They say, go by yourself, no entourage, no family, no nothing. Go and play on a surface you haven't been playing on and get brought back down to earth. And there are a few players that had maybe won matches at Wimbledon, beaten great players as well. Some big wins. We're talking top 20 wins, picking up a nice check, thinking that, you know, they're the bee's knees. And yeah, coaches would step in and say, right, you're going here. And they would send them off to somewhere in Eastern Europe where there's no one there. They're playing absolute dirt ballers, and they usually got beaten quite quickly. and I remember having conversations with them afterwards, and they'd be like, yeah, no, it was quite good. Back down to earth now. So,
and when it came, especially in the lead up to Wimbledon, did you find that you had, maybe not friends, but acquaintances that maybe you hadn't heard from since preschool, suddenly getting in touch saying, oh, wow, you're at Wimbledon. Any chance of getting tickets?
I mean, I was the most popular person in June and July. It was amazing. I mean, people didn't even make an attempt to like bluff it from the beginning of the year, or kind of, you know, when you get to March or something. Oh, hey, how are you? And then pipe up again in June. People literally just come in June, haven't spoken to you all year, no interest in your tennis, anything. And it will probably be, sometimes it's like the week before Wimbledon and it's just, hey, have you got any tickets? And it's unbelievable.
But were you so shocked at that kind of direct approach that you said yes? Or did you stick to, no, you know, I can't get hold of them?
Oh, no, I would never give it to anyone like that. I'd rather give it to somebody in the queue. that was crazy. Yeah, no, my general rule, if I ever had any excess tickets, which did not happen, you don't get many tickets. The assumption is that we can get as many tickets as we like. And again, being British, you're treated like a top 10 player, so you do get some extra tickets, but you don't get a huge amount. It really can be limited, especially if you're bringing more than one person as your little entourage. So if you've got a coach and an S&C trainer and those sorts of things, you're pretty much using up all your allocated spots anyway. So for me, it was just, if somebody got in touch and said, oh, hey, I'm going to queue so I can see you or whatever, then that I'd be much more likely to say, oh, I have a spare ticket if you don't want to queue. I think people who would kind of try and queue as much, I had so many family members queue overnight to see me play. It was awesome. But I couldn't do anything about that. There was like 30 of them. I was like, I can't get you all tickets.
Any friends of Naomi listening, in the run-up to tournaments now that she works at, starting in Wimbledon, maybe start contacting her around January, February, ask how she is, ask how married life is, ask how work's going, and then probably by Wimbledon, they'd be in a good spot.
Yeah, maybe. You never know.
Is that right? Okay.
You never know. No, I just, like, the thing is that I've always been really quite funny about it. And I don't want tickets to go to people who just want to go because it's a status thing and because they know me. I want people to go because they love tennis or they're actually interested in me. So either or. So I really love giving somebody who is a diehard tennis fan who's never been to Wimbledon the opportunity to get inside the gates.
Now, the top British players, male and female, they're not going to have to worry about demand for tickets because tennis is returning, but it's returning behind closed doors. Now, was it 2-3 weeks ago we talked about you're going to help me out here. Was it the closed women, the British closed? See, I've already got it wrong. What is it called?
Yeah, something like that. The British closed national championship.
The British closed women's Championships 2020.
National Championships 2020.
Was there a national? I'm sure there wasn't a national. Was there a national in there?
Yeah.
So, as you can see, we didn't get it right. Probably didn't get it right at the time, but it's been changed. It's the same event that we were talking about, that Naomi was telling you about, but it's now the Progress Tour Women's Championships, and it's going to feature some of the top female players. British number three, Harriet Dart, at the moment is leading the way in terms of rankings. At the moment, Johanna Konta, who is the British number one, world number 14, not expected to take part. Former top 100 player Naomi Brody has signed up, along with 17-year-old Emma Raducanu. Now, the event is taking place outdoor courts, National Tennis Centre, London, from the 14th to the 18th of July, because tennis is returning.
I know. Get excited. Won't be on grass, though.
Nope.
I think grass competitively is done for the year, but very exciting. Harriet Dart leading the way as British number three. Lots of interest, and I'm looking forward to watching it, really.
There's a prize fund of £30,000. We've also got eight doubles teams taking part, and that's the other thing we've got to remember, that and we talk about this, you know, we're not earning money at the moment. We're kind of waiting for sport to get going again, but these guys, yes, there'll be certain players who have sponsorship deals and some bits coming in, but they are not earning the money they would have been earning because they haven't been able to work.
Yes, but to be fair, in Britain, the LTA have produced a really healthy package for those players. It's pretty much all of the players playing in this event that have been targeted, and they have been supported by the LTA, and they've done a really good job. Unfortunately, we don't have a governing body to do that for us, but they've benefited from it. But yeah, absolutely. Look, they want to play tennis. They want to get on court. They want to be competitive. They want to play matches. And that's what they're going to do.
And we've also got Jamie Murray's Battle of the Brits. Now, that is going to feature brother Andy, Dan Evans, Kyle Edmund. That's also taking place at National Tennis Centre. But that's the first event, because that's the 23rd to the 28th of June. And again, just to say, both events are going to be played behind closed doors. I believe they are going to be televised. It's just great because these players, they must look, we are desperate to get back and to work and to cover tennis and football and whatever other sports, but these, they must be pretty excited to know there's a tournament coming up that they can actually play in.
Yeah, it just gives them a focus. I mean, these are goal-orientated people, and you need to have the next thing coming. And also with tennis, we're so spoiled in the fact that we have tournaments week after week after week. I think you can pretty much play every week of the year if you want to. I think you can play every week of the year if you want to. I think Benoit Paire tried to do that last year. He'd played every possible week up to the French Open, and because he just hates training. He was like, look, I either play matches or I train, so I prefer to play matches. But they need something coming on the horizon. And actually, it's not too far away.
I know. We're in June, aren't we? Yeah. So it's this month it's going to be happening. I saw a tweet, and it said, so if I get this right, Dominic Thiem will play on clay the 7th to the 11th of July, on grass the 13th to the 15th of July, and then on hard courts the 17th to the 19th of July.
Yeah, interesting. He's an animal, isn't he?
Does that sound like Dominic Thiem?
So it's just so him, isn't it? Set himself a challenge. I think he's probably making a statement saying, I would have won slams on all surfaces this year.
I'm just going to play on every... Well, he has been... I remember before events started to be cancelled or postponed, you'd see Dominic Thiem saying, oh, I'm practicing on the clay. Then it was, oh, I've started work on the grass. So he probably thinks he's put all the effort in that if there's a tournament... And I know, is there a tournament in Germany that has invited Roger Federer and Angelique Kerber to take part if they want to play some tennis? So there are these little tournaments popping up all over the place, and also the door is still open for the US Open, not only to take place, but to take place at the same time of year and in New York City.
Yes, which I think even from kind of quite early on in the lockdown, that was almost the benchmark, especially once Wimbledon got cancelled. I mean, look, it's still up in the air.
Well, there's lots of different bits and pieces, aren't there? Because initially they said the US Open wouldn't take place behind closed doors, but I think they've had to concede that if it is to take place in New York during the same dates, you wouldn't be allowed fans. And obviously a lot about testing a lot about how they'd get the players in, maybe charter flights and kind of sort of get them all in together. There are going to be fewer officials on the court. Maybe they would close the changing rooms on practice days, and maybe they'd use the hospitality suites as individual locker rooms. So you might find players have their own locker room just to contain them and the virus and stop the spread of the disease. So they're obviously trying everything to make this event happen. We know that Wimbledon was cancelled, Australian Open was able to take place. The French, it's still sort of looking at its exact dates, but end of September, October for the French to take place. The US, they really want it to happen. The players would love it to happen, but it's going to be strange, isn't it? If it takes place, it is going to look so different to any other Grand Slam we have ever seen.
It would be quite extraordinary. And I thought it was kind of, well, we've had it at quite a few places now, in Paris last year, but the year before they build the roof, you kind of have a weird open structure, don't you? So remember, Centre Court was kind of enclosed. They had to take it all off, and there was this weird open bowl sort of feel. And I always remember thinking, like, oh, this is quite a unique thing to be a part of, because it's going to obviously be closed up and be back to being Centre Court and have the roof and that sort of thing. It will never feel like this again. And it's just thinking that's quite minor in comparison to the difference that this year's US Open is going to have in terms of the feel between normal times. There'll be a huge amount different, I suppose, but surely the main thing for them is getting the matches played, getting them on TV. And just, I mean, I kind of feel a bit bad because it's almost like it's going to be a bit of a test run, a bit of a guinea pig, which is crazy to think of a slam like that. I think they'd probably be hoping they can play a tournament or two before so that, you know, they can at least try out a few of the different systems, because otherwise it's going to be quite tough, just because the nature of a slam is there are so many people, 128 draw in women's and in men's singles, doubles, mixed, qualifying, juniors. Are these all happening now? Like, are they going to scrap some things? You would imagine something like a mixed doubles could probably go. But then it's not about the time on court. They don't need to save time on court. They need to stop there being so many players, I suppose. Do they? Or do they not? I don't know.
Well, if anyone's going to trial it, then it would be a Grand Slam because they have the money. It's going to be very difficult for smaller tournaments to enforce a few of the things that the US Open might enforce, as in chartering planes and bringing a load of people in from a certain destination on a plane. And they have the space to possibly give a large number of players their own locker rooms. I mean, these are things that smaller tournaments just, they haven't got, it's just not worth it. As much as they need the revenue, the money they would have to outlay to make it safe for everyone. And they heavily rely on spectators. So I guess if there's going to be a guinea pig, then a Grand Slam, an association, is a good way to start.
Yeah, it's looking more and more like the French Open has nailed this. They get to see how US Open pans out, learn from all of their mistakes, be nice and organise themselves. They've got the roof sorted for the autumn in Paris, although I don't know how many matches you can quite get on that court in a day. Yeah, they could be doing all right.
I just keep thinking how cold that's going to be. Now, you said something just now that is a very controversial statement at the moment. You said if the US Open were to go ahead, maybe they could get rid of mixed doubles.
Oh, I know. Look, it is a statement, and I'm not saying that I want them to get rid of mixed doubles. I'm not saying that I want them to get rid of it permanently at all. And also, I don't know if they're trying to reduce the amount of players on site, but if they were trying to reduce the amount of players on site, you would have to be looking at mixed doubles, junior events, qualifying, as to whether those things should go ahead. But people might think it's controversial, but not quite as controversial as our friend Marion Bartoli has been this week with her statements, which it's not the case, but have kind of been misconstrued as she hates doubles and wants to scrap it all. That's not what she said at all, but some people are kind of reacting as if she has said that.
Yeah, I mean, the comments, she questioned the work ethic of doubles players. I mean,
it's not a good start. You're not getting people on side, are you?
And that's not. And I'll give you the direct quote.
Did she not learn from Dominic Thiem?
So apparently not. She the exact quote was, "I just don't understand, because in doubles you just don't make the same effort as a singles player.
Well, in the match, she's absolutely right. Now, and I don't think any doubles player can deny that. Like, I would agree with her that within the match, you do not make the same physical effort as a singles player. And I know coming to the net and slamming on the breaks, it's tiring, it's difficult. But it's quite an obvious trend that players who finish their singles career continue to play doubles. Somebody like a Max Murney, Martina Hingis. It happens all the time because you don't have to move as much physically. Recreational players, once they get to the age where they cannot run and change direction without kind of getting injured or their body breaking down, they move to doubles. So you have half the court to cover. I agree. I hope that's not too controversial. For me, that seems fairly obvious. But within the match, I think it's quite an assumption that I would not make. I do not make the assumption that doubles players don't work as hard as singles players in general.
It's look, she did say, look, I don't know if you have to stop doubles completely. I'm just trying to sort of sit on the fence a little bit here with a comment. But she said to get less money and to give the money to qualification and others could be the solution for the people who are losing out money at the moment. She was saying, well, maybe don't have doubles played every week. Don't have doubles played in every tournament and use that money to bolster the pot for the singles players, which she believes, I guess the argument is there, because they are working harder, they deserve more money. But then you're going to get the doubles players saying, well, look, we work hard, we train every day, we are professional to the max, so we deserve to be out there and to be out there playing. I mean, she's opened a little bit of a can of worms here. I mean, I saw the likes of Nicola Mahu, Grand Slam winner.
Well, he's not going to like it, is he?
Her countryman sort of saying, oh, right. And I think the other thing, it was about specific entourages, because she made a point to say, why... I see a lot of this. Why do doubles players need six people in their entourage? And I think that's what he sort of bit back at and said, well, I've never had six people travelling with me.
Yeah, and I must say that I haven't seen that. You know, I reckon doubles players, say we're talking about the top 30 doubles players in the world. So people who are in with a shout of winning slams, they play on the tour, they're earning a decent living from the sport. I don't think I've ever seen anyone with that amount of people with them. Even like the Bryan brothers, who are complete superstars. I do really disagree with that. Doubles players, as I did refer to, and Mahu and Herbert are kind of an exception, aren't they? Because they're, of course, singles players to a very high level as well. And of course, that does happen. I mentioned Max Murney in the men's and in the women's. It happens all over the place where people play singles and doubles. I mean, Ash Barty, for example, you could say she's the best singles player and probably the best doubles player around. But for the most part, on the men's tour with the doubles, they do tend to be double specialists. And as I was just mentioning, they can get injured a little more. They can be a bit older, those sorts of things. So they do tend to travel with physios. I've known them to travel with physios or have a physio that works with a few different doubles players and goes to the tournament, that sort of thing. They probably travel with a coach some of the time. The main thing that they need is like data analysis. They need to do the scouting of their opponents. But other than that, a girlfriend or another half, that's kind of about it. You don't really see kind of parents and all sorts coming. So yeah, I really don't know where she's got that from.
But how do you define an entourage? Is an entourage people you are paying to work for you? Or is she looking at people who have got wives, girlfriends, husbands and children with them? And therefore you look into the box and you see loads of people. Is an entourage family or is it people you pay?
Interesting point.
Because you look up into a box. I mean, we've talked about Coco Gauff in the past and I've looked up and there's been sort of 10, 11, 12 rows. Now, that seems largely entourage-y. That's not even a word. But in terms of people, agents and managers and promotional people and this and that and sponsors, and obviously her parents are there front and centre. But, you know, anyone I can look up and see, especially as double players, as they get a bit older, they start having Nicola Mahu's son, who runs on court and hugs his dad. And, you know, so I'm not sure in terms of an entourage, if she's talking six people, if we're talking sort of physios and fitness trainers and agents and manager, I'm not sure I've seen that many doubles players with six people on the payroll possibly with them. But then if we're talking about family, I don't know if you can... I think that's really nice if a family is travelling around to support you.
Yeah, I don't think she's talking about that, because that would be a bit silly, really, because it makes complete sense. Because the doubles players travel just as much as the singles players. There's no difference there. They go to all the same tournaments. So, yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know really what she's... I can kind of see a bit of logic, but I just think that there's just too many assumptions. It's too blanket on all doubles players, and saying that people are traveling with these big entourages. Honestly, I've never seen it. I don't know. My brother worked on the doubles tour for a long time, working with some top players, and it would probably be him and possibly a physio at the max. And as I say, maybe a girlfriend, like, or a other half, that would be the absolute maximum. So yeah, I don't really get, she must have just seen one incident, so maybe one person had lots of people with them, and she's maybe just referring to that, because it's not normal.
We should say congratulations to Marion Bartley and her husband, because she's expecting a baby this year.
Yes she is. Brilliant news. So I'm sure that will keep her occupied. And if the doubles players can say, it's okay, Marion's busy.
I remember actually speaking to her at Wimbledon last year, and she was with her now husband, and she talked about really wanting to become a mum. And it was something she said that's really important to her, and she really wanted to become a mum. And it looks like that wish is going to come true later this year. So congratulations to Marion Bartley. Now, last week, the end of last week's episode, we were talking about Naomi Osaka.
Yeah, being the highest paid athlete of all time, female athlete of all time, with her $37.5 million. And I was just saying that I did pick up on it, but I just didn't talk about it last week, that the top spot for the men's is Federer. First time ever tennis has been the top sport for the men on the men's Forbes 100 list, and the first time ever that any sport has held the top spot of both men's and women's, and of course it's tennis. And the reason is because the top earning female athlete has only ever been from tennis since 1990. So if any other sport was going to do it, they'd have to wade their way through quite a lot of tennis players to get to the top on the women's side. But look, a huge achievement again for tennis, really holding its own with the big sports. I think the sport with the most athletes in the top 100 for the earnings was basketball, then it was NFL, then it was soccer, and then it was tennis. So I think that's pretty good company to keep up there in fourth position. We had a total of six, I believe. So great stuff, including two women.
And it was interesting, when we were talking about Naomi Osaka, you said that when you first saw her, the first thought wasn't necessarily that she was going to be winning Grand Slams, etc., etc. It's something she's gone on to do. She has a lot of influence already. I mean, you've talked about in terms of her earnings, where she already is at the age she is. And now with recent tragic and horrible events in America, she is adding a very powerful voice to the protests that have been taking place.
Yeah. No, she's been outspoken on social media, as quite a few of the players have been doing, quite a lot of people have been doing, really, and really using their platforms. And we were talking about it a while ago, because we were talking about Djokovic using his platform for certain things. It wasn't necessarily sort of activism in any way or anything political, but he was still promoting, I suppose, his philosophy on life, his ideology, I suppose. And we were saying maybe that's not the best use of a platform. But what do you think about what they've been saying?
I think, and we should also mention Coco Gauff in this, and remember that Coco Gauff is still very young, but she already has a very powerful voice. And Naomi Osaka, one of the things she said is, silence is betrayal. And I'm sure everyone knows what we're talking about. It was the George Floyd murder that's led to the protests in America. And Naomi Osaka was present at a protest, and she posted a video. Francis Tiafoe and his girlfriend did the rackets down, hands up. And I think I was listening to Chanda Rubin, who was speaking on the Tennis Channel, and they were speaking about it. And she knows the Tiafoe family very well. And she was saying it was something that Francis's twin brother Franklin and Francis's girlfriend came up with. And they pretty much, and they've got Serena Williams as part of this. I think Heather Watson's on this video. They've got black players from other sports. They've got very influential people. But in the space of about 24 hours, they got all the video messages together. It's just the rackets down, hands up. And they put this together in the space of 24 hours and put it out there. Because as we've talked about with tennis players, some tennis players say, look, we don't really want to be role models. We're just here doing our thing. But they have to accept that when they get to a certain level, they have a lot of people looking up to them. They have big platforms on social media and people listen to what they say. And Naomi Osaka, who herself has said she's very shy, she's also very passionate. And she's saying, look, I don't want to stay quiet. I want to make myself heard. And that's what she's been doing. And I think it's fantastic. I think we talked about Novak Djokovic. That was just a little bit more. He's obviously talking about something he very much believes in. It's the responsibility of using the platform that you have. And I think it's great. I think it's great that the likes of Coco Gauff, Naomi Osaka, Frances Tiafoe with this campaign have been using their voices.
Just really good that they've kind of stood up. They've jumped right to it. And I mean, I would just add that personally, I'm in 100% support of their message and what they're trying to do. And we're in a sport, I suppose, we had such huge influences early on, didn't we? And people have been inspired and inspired by the Williams sisters, maybe inspired by Arthur Ashe, whoever it may be. And for them to now try and stand up and inspire others, especially, as you say, as young as Coco Gauff, is pretty impressive.
I absolutely agree with everything you say. And just again, to think about being the age of Coco Gauff and having the voice that she's got is so powerful. And I think she's going to be huge for the sport and maybe transcend the sport like the Williams sisters have done so successfully. And when you think of the platform and the voice that she already has.
I agree. I think she really is already sort of transcending the sport. People who don't know anything about tennis and can probably name two or three players would know about Coco Gauff, especially in the States. I think she'll be absolutely huge because she's clearly a phenomenal player. So she's going to win some big tournaments. And I can't believe how young she is. She is so mature for her age. We've seen that on the court in terms of the fact that she comes back from when she's down. She plays the big moments really well. She gets big wins. She was a lucky loser when she was playing in Linz, and then she came back into the main draw and won the tournament. There is just so much about her that is so, so impressive. And I do think that it is difficult because I don't sign up to the belief that because you are an athlete, that automatically makes you a role model and you need to be responsible. I think you can choose to be a role model if you want to. And, these players are choosing to be a role model, choosing to be influential and inspirational. And I think that is great. Then you get held to a higher standard if you choose to put yourself forward in that way. So it is something that is impressive because it would be easy to not do it and to not ruffle feathers or irritate fans or anything like that and to just stay quiet. It's not an easy thing to do to start getting involved in politics on a public platform when you're that big.
Something I was meaning to ask you, I mentioned quite near the beginning of the pod about Harriet Dart. I know she's a good friend of yours. What's it like for her? You must have chatted about what it feels like for her to be back and playing and just getting out there again. How's she dealt with lockdown? How does she feel about being back?
Yeah, I think actually, we've chatted a few times. She's been pretty positive about the whole thing, really. She's just that sort of person. Just get on with whatever life sort of dishes out and deal with it as best you can and move forward. It is what it is. She's been training a lot. That's been keeping her busy. She did talk to me a little bit about the fact that she has noticed the motivation is different because you're always on your own. So you have to motivate yourself for every session to push that a little bit harder to do that extra rep. And yeah, you can wear your heart rate monitor and send the information back to your coach and that sort of thing. But there's nothing quite like having somebody standing next to you screaming in your face, trying to make you get it done. So I think that is possibly the hardest thing. But as you were saying, with these tournaments now on the horizon, that gives that extra motivation, that extra bit of a boost. So, yeah, I think really sort of lots of positives. She's also had quite a lot of niggles through the years. So really just trying to rehab everything as best as possible and just be fresh and raring to go. I mean, there's no point turning up injured, is there? You can't possibly do that. I can understand you getting
injured.
It's not
ideal.
But yeah, no, so she's, yeah, she's doing all right. And I think from speaking to her and some other players, and it seems like most people are kind of taking that sort of approach.
That is the hardest thing. It's the self-motivation. I mean, I don't normally train with someone yelling at me. I don't have a fitness trainer or a physio. I sometimes have you, though, don't I? Sometimes I'd send you messages saying, I'm going to do this, and I'd let you know when I've done it, or I'll send you a picture of the treadmill or whatever it is, or yeah, a photo of where I've got to on my runs. It's just having a little bit... Like today, I forced myself to go. My body started falling to pieces again. You know, I told you how it had nicely healed from not running for 7 weeks. It's yeah. I mean, I'm still working my way back to anything like I was before. But yeah, no, the aches and pains are back, and it's I think it's just old age or getting older. But it's definitely harder. But I've got to start thinking about school.
Well, I was just going to ask, have you made a decision?
Yeah, we're going to send the boys to school. So it'll be 2 days a week, slightly reduced hours and small groups. So the maximum that will be in their group or their bubble or their pod, whatever they're being referred to, will be seven. And when you think there's already two of them, so that's five other children. I think this is such an individual thing. I've spoken to loads of mums and they're not sure. And, you know, what are you doing? Is it right for us? But I think it's so individual how people deal with this. I think because the doctors believe I've had the virus, I think we're a little bit more relaxed. The school, they seem to have put some amazing measures in, you know, in terms of the things the boys can't take things in with them, like, I don't know, book bags or lunches or whatever. Washing their hands all the time, they'll have to stay. You know, how you're going to socially distance a bunch of 4 and 5 year olds, I still don't get that. Because the first thing little children do when they see their friends, they just run up to each other. We're comfortable with it, but I know there's lots of parents that aren't. And I really think it depends. I'm looking forward, from our point of view, for the boys having a little bit of normality. Maybe a little bit of proper teaching. I managed to get half an hour's homeschooling out of them today so far.
That's good.
Yeah, where is it?
Well, let's hope the teachers manage it just a little bit.
Yeah,
more.
I think they're definitely, after half an hour, they were like, have we finished now? Have we done it now? And then one of them just sort of walked off. I was like, okay, that would be half an hour. So I'm trying to make it a very constructive half an hour. And I think the school have been really good. They've tried to put them with their friends. You know, so right. If they're really... And they're obviously not going to separate the twins.
Yeah, I mean, that would be rubbish, right?
Well, it would also...
They're in different pods.
It would also be counterproductive, because if someone in a pod is believed to have it, you send the whole pod home, the whole pod go to self-isolation. So then, because they split the twins up, they'd have to send the other pod home too.
Yeah, that would not make any sense. It seems like they're relatively switched on at your school.
Yeah, it seems, but again, everyone's different. It'd be interesting to hear from people out there who have children what they're doing and how they feel about it. But as I say, I think because I've had it, it made the decision a bit easier to send them back. And then when they're at school, I can try and get stuff sorted for their birthday. One bike's got to go back.
Why?
It's just, I think the size is wrong. And every bikes are sold out everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. The bikes do not exist.
Are they super expensive?
They can be. We've managed to get an all right price, but because we're going to have to get two, they can be. But we went to a couple of shops and called a couple of shops. They don't have a single bike left in the whole shop.
Wow.
Yes. So I'm going to sort out bikes, birthdays, and have a little break from homeschooling, which I think is a positive for everybody. Yeah, so it's just, look, things are easing, aren't they? I know in some parts of the world they are not, but over in the UK, things are, I think from the 14th of this month, they're going to, non-essential shops can open.
Yeah.
There's a real feeling of normality about it, apart from the fact we should be in Paris eating baguettes and watching tennis, and the grass court season should have started.
Yeah, there are certain industries that are going to take a little bit longer to get off the ground, aren't they? We just happen to be part of one of them. But when it comes to tennis, doubles... I think you can play doubles now, or maybe from next week, but doubles is back on the cards. So singles, sorry, Marion, but it's back. No, I say that in jest. She didn't. That's not what she meant. Come on.
And you are feeling positive about some professional tennis this year. And I'm talking, it's great that we've got these tournaments, in the little tournaments within the countries happening, right? I'm not talking about those, but you are now more positive of an international tournament taking place in 2020.
Yes, I do think much more positively about it. Yes.
Okay, that we're going to end it there because it's a positive. We're going to end on a positive that there will be competitive,
run away,
international. Yeah, stop talking. International tennis in 2020.
Yes,
love it. Okay, bye.
Can't wait.
Bye.